So would it be appropriate for me to go directly to my story from here, or should I go to the front page first to avoid creating spurious soft links?
Yay, spurious soft links!
And the more important question is, how spurious would the soft link really be?
You're logged in as guest user, you won't make a soft link.
Guest user doesn't make... Oh, yeah.
But guest user got moved.
They fixed it.
All right. I could talk about this at great length, but it already is great length. Some people in Toronto had the misfortune of hearing me talk about what I'm about to read for quite a while in August, and I've resolved not to do that again. I'm provoked.
What are you about to read?
You'll find out when I start reading it.
Okay.
I was very interested in the... I am typing what I'm saying also, which is not what I want to look up. I was very interested in the whole process by which these were selected, specifically in the regards that the material that was eventually decided on by the voting committee on what they wanted to hear did not reflect which nominations had the most highest reputation in the database, or even which ones had received the most visitation by electors in terms of seeing what was up for nomination for the reading. Something that didn't make it was higher up in the soft link list on the bottom. I'm not sure how that happened, but I'm kind of rambling. I'm just going to arrange things so I can do some directed rambling instead of improvisational rambling. I've gone the whole time without a chair. It would seem strange to get one now. I'll just...
If it's directed rambling, is it really... Rambling?
I'll make sweet, sweet... Yeah. Don't be like that, baby. Oh, yeah.
You know, I have to go home.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Am I in good microphone zone? It's kind of... Well, yeah, all right. I think we're out of tape, maybe. I don't know. But it was being broadcast. It's a story.
Who are you?
Huh?
Who are you?
Oh, my God! I have said a lot, but I haven't said anything important yet. My name is Rowan. My account name is pseudo-intellectual. I use everything too a lot.
Most.
The title of the thing I'm reading is called I Swallow with Eyes That Eat. I think you people are maniacs because it takes me about 20 minutes to read, yet strangely, this is what you guys wanted me to read. So apparently you are as in love with the sound of my voice as I am. That may change after I'm done, but it will be too late for you. So it came to pass in the age of Polaroid that late one night, as is wont to happen after holidays and natural disasters, a clerk was busy at work developing rolls of photographs, pictures of the Grand Canyon and Aunt Martha and the 400-foot ash cone that had been left in the backyard after the eruption. As the witching hours drew longer and the reek of chemicals began to cloud his mind, as legend dictates, he began to deviate a bit from standard photo-developing technique. Now, some will say that it happened because of a spilled can of cola. Another say he was a spy technology smuggler from Japan. Some fancy an errant bolt of lightning during that dry, intense night's atmosphere, but these are all just rumors, drawing away from the soul of the story. You see, it turned out that he discovered a new technique for developing film, one which produced prints so vivid and realistic that they were generally held to be an improvement on the original subject matter. No one knows who this legendary technician was, or if he ever existed at all, but that's not important to the account. What is important is that he forgot to patent the process, and thanks to his negligence, the whole world was given the gift of this awesome reaction. Film stores everywhere adapted to the new standard or went out of business. Thus was the public's hunger for these improvements on reality, for an escape, albeit how slight, from the world in front of them. Now, there was just one side effect of this process which could be considered bad. Whatever occurred to animate the prints so, as an aside, also irreparably damaged the negatives. This was a stark concern for 2 months, as multiple prints required tremendously greater quantities of film, and even so, the results couldn't always be duplicated. But this was all solved, however, when some anonymous mind, again one philanthropic in his laxity under copyright laws, came up with the ingenious idea of taking pictures of the pictures. And this is where the problem first made itself apparent. You see, as the first set of pictures were improvements upon the mundane reality of the original subjects, the second iteration improved the image that much more. A print at this stage would seem four times as appealing as it originally was. Advertisers went nuts. They reasoned, and quite correctly, that this process was exponential. Hence, you could take pictures of pictures indefinitely until you'd arrived at a vision of an infinitieth away from perfection. Chaos broke out in the streets of the developed world. Husbands and wives would whisper most passionately in each other's ears when diverting their eyes from the base and real, instead addressing a tenderly held framed print of Sir Reality as it was described as an improvement on reality. People began attaching, through clips, tape, or other adhesives, idealized photographs of themselves to their foreheads so they could be addressed directly without dishonoring their co-converser by forcing them to see gritty, filthy reality. New mothers in hospitals waited 3 hours for the prints to be returned before bringing the purple monsters to their swollen breasts. Adolescent boys would masturbate at surrealized representations of cars, aeroplanes, cans of Campbell's soup. Doctors and employers both were concerned as workers would gaze for hours on pictures of dolphins, raw meat, or even themselves as they might be depicted in their greatest and most fantastic dreams, forgetting to show up to work, call in sick, or even take the time to eat or defecate. Still, stylized graphs, charts, and x-ray diagrams always cast the bad news in the best light possible. Indeed, medical practices of many kinds managed to prosper from this strange love from the public, especially those involving cosmetic surgery. Tattoos were no longer removed, but instead received special layered enhancements underneath the skin, whereby grafting the picture directly onto the patient's surface not only improved the reception of the pigmented image, but also ameliorated the general tone of the skin and such reflection of the patient's well-being on a whole. A tattoo on its own was worthless, but after a few repetitions of this formidable procedure, it became obviously more pleasing than the most flawless of natural skins, even the highlights of sores and past scars coming to life and telling their own stories in marvelous relief. The richest of the rich, not content to see their waking share of beauty, arranged for such surreal images to be implanted on the insides of their eyelids out of sharp focus to compensate for the extreme closeness and illuminated by small light bulbs inserted into the tear ducts. A popular imitation in poverty-stricken lands was merely to tear off the eyelids completely, leaving the optic sensors open to receive such visible delights even when one was asleep. Now, it had been known for quite some time that the augmenting effects remained puissant, though to a far lesser degree on pictures where there was contained text. Stop signs and corporate names typically underwent the process a few times over to ensure they weren't ignored altogether, but the process to render mere words more appealing proved costly and inefficient, where 10 iterations of a catchy icon could supplant thousands of repetitions on an exposure of more alphanumeric symbols. By and large, the written word was phased out, for a picture was, after all, worth at least 1,000 words. Intelligentsia, academics, philosophers, logicians, engineers, and scientists of all sorts no longer hunched over desks or tables, but instead reclining in lounge seats, gazing placidly at wall-mounted poster-sized blow-ups of images gotten from the long-disused eyepieces of microscopes, precise gradations on drafting equipment, and readouts of gauges and dials. They were rightly alarmed by all of these goings-on. Words had always been the primary means of expressing precise logic, identifiers, etc. Pictures were quite handy, but things were getting to the point where one aptly presented graphic could sway the perception of major theses and proofs. Obviously, academia had to do something to save the human race from falling into inescapable aesthetic hiddenism, its descent briefly broken by bouts of illiteracy and endemic ignorance. They immediately set about tinkering with the various elements and forces in that elusive but widespread mysterious photographic process, putting what remained of their brain power to work fighting for its very survival. And within months, a solution had been found, a refinement of the process by which text could be rendered simply and inexpensively as appealing as photographs which had undergone the process many times over. It was deemed a full success. And students at institutions around the world celebrated by covering university campuses with graffiti, graffiti which was soon covered up with pictures of the same. Pages torn from dictionaries enjoyed a resurgence in popularity, if only as a novel wallpaper pattern. And books and writing became the objects of a brief but intense love affair from the public. The regurgitated text allowed people to feel good about investing hours spent poring over sheets of dead tree, and long-closed bookstores were restored in the second childhood that only a passing fad can trigger, inundated by colors for the most aesthetically pleasing, the least offensive, and above all, the most satisfying reads possible. Complete volumes of Camus and Kafka went untouched, but with minor revision, the vast majority of literature could be distilled into palatable tales of two optimisms, where it was the best of times and the best of all possible worlds. The greatness of a work soon became apparent by virtue of the speed with which it could arrive at a satisfying conclusion. If the past works of great literature were lacking such, ghostwriters joined forces with ghost editors and together gave literary plastic surgery to the greatest works of the 20th century and beyond, so that the masses responded to the savages' attentions to Lenina in much the same way as they did to the Feely theaters. And these professional hacks knew that they had outdone themselves when they managed to leave a reader sympathizing for Alex's forlorn need for the stirring tunes of Lily Vaughn and Winston's ultimate love for Big Brother. No one spoke about the rearrangement and omission of a few ugly words and distasteful phrases. They couldn't remember the book ever having been this beautiful in the first place, and they certainly weren't going to act against this wonderful process. Eventually, this comeback, however, was given a boost by the still impressive forces of the graphic, which had not been forgotten by the public. Indeed, when the two media combined forces once again to provide the formidable and venerable vehicle of the picture book, the flaring heyday of the word was already over. Passages of nice things were enhanced, then supplanted by pictures of nice things, and convoluted plots were slowly but surely broken down into images of fewer twists and turns, until the length of a book could be diminished tenfold while the enjoyment of it still be increased. This desperate attempt to preserve society as we know it was pronounced dead when they began replacing book titles and author names with tasteful reproductions of kittens, palm trees, and carrion birds. The focus had returned inevitably to the instant and gratifying fix this sneak peek could provide over the slow and imperfect thrill derived from wasting time skimming over dialogue, literary devices, and plot development, and then pondering and considering its washed-away message, often while looking at nothing more beauteous than the insides of one's eyelids. A complete write-off. Eventually, it was decided that man's ultimate calling truly was the organized and ritual viewing of such images, and clever and cunning machines and software were crafted to allow every adult to spend only a half of an hour of every day at work, mostly in vast film-developing complexes, the rest of the day being dedicated to sitting in long rows and frugal chairs, uncomfortable but unnoticed, gazing upon a wide, vast gallery of enhanced pictures, a surreal spectacle, that of the silent and awed masses enthralled by the surreality of visions of beaches, forests, the eyes of a mighty stag, and those of a killer. While it was to have been expected, perhaps, it is surprising that this did not happen sooner. A blind man, whipped into a frothing rage at his apparent inability to appreciate those finest things in life, managed to find his way to a gallery, despite an inability to consult large, friendly reproductions of maps and street names. And White Cane, flailing erratically like a lizard's broken-off tail, ripped a poster in two, tearing a terrible crevice down its flawless, sheening surface. A jury of 12-sighted folk condemned him to death for the crime of blasphemy. This started a chain reaction where hordes of God's chosen, those who could see the divine apparitions he had allowed his children to create, rose up and, in a swift, bloody movement, executed savage pity upon those who had been deprived of the ability to worship properly. The blind were rounded up and locked away, and those who required glasses or bifocals were regarded, when at all, as highly suspect. As has probably been noted by now, the subject matter of the picture of the picture of the picture mattered hardly at all in relation to what pleasure was derived from its viewing, masses reacting equally well to displays of rippling puddles, miraculous fetuses in the womb, and man's ultimate expression of power, mushroom clouds billowing menacingly but beautifully. Of course, everyone was too busy looking into surreality to actually spend the time singing in the rain, making babies, or detonating bombs, but archives provided an ample supply of past experiences which could be relived and better through this irreplaceable process. Any image, given sufficient dedicated repetition of the process, could be rendered equally appealing, and they could all attain the penultimate pinnacle of beauty regardless of what their source was. But eventually, even that rule was broken. Perhaps it was instinct, or mere shadows of a mother's whispered warning long ago, but there was one thing which was rarely gazed upon and never captured on film: the celestial orb above. Traditional photography made it nearly impossible to take fairly representative pictures of that jewel in the sky without running the risk of overexposed film and damage to equipment, both the camera and the photographer's eye. This unwritten rule followed through in this aesthetic movement, but when all else had been captured to film and honed to a perfect print, this lonely star alone remained to leave its inalterable imprint on celluloid, immortalized as an image over the functions it served. With only two or three iterations, prints of the sun quickly came to note for their exclusive and exquisite beauty, singular and unique among the blocks and blocks of static, surreal glaciers, lions, hummingbirds, and paramecia. Heads began to turn to the rising star, or at least wallet-sized versions of it, and soon its shining face was to be seen peeking from every street corner and in the wrapping of any package. This was to be the era of the sun, the dawning of a new age, and cults sprung up in veneration of its perfect image, considered by many to be the face of God. Weather machines were devised to divert clouds to uninhabited regions, and early one morning, midway between dawn and noon, a joint project sponsored by the 12 greatest nations on Earth took place many miles up, where a series of shuttles and satellites came together to construct what had long been thought blasphemous but now was universally regarded as the only remaining course of action. Tubes and reinforcements came together in zero gravity, and by the time the sun was at its highest, measured in the time zone of the most populous region of the planet, of course, the field was activated. The sun had been framed, and new images of itself, propagated through holograph and lenses, appeared in the sky, showering the entire world with the benign rays of a more perfect star. One truly could make out divine features in the radiant face, and as one, the world turned to see the most glorious sight possible. Faces twisted and contorted into grotesque masks of rapturous ecstasy, and their minds exploded as their eyes turned dark, to savor forever the most perfect sight possible in the universe. The legions of the newly blind, though it would no longer serve them, tried to position themselves so that they would be facing the heavenly object, that God might see them as they had seen him. And as it swept over their faces, the light reflected in their rotting eyes, slowly clouded and faded to a dull, sullen glow of decay and eternity. After the cities and megalopoli of the world were silent for many days, the few remaining blind freed themselves from their captivity. Coming upon the silent and unmoving shells of their former friends and relatives, many still living, they moaned and beat their breasts and plucked out their own inoffensive eyes in tragic fury. Still, theirs was the world to inherit. They had lost nothing, and their daring resourcefulness allowed the world to live again. You may have noticed that many a grizzled storyteller is blind. This harkens back to tradition of the Norse and the Greeks and beyond, for only one possessed by the spirit of the story can repeat it properly, objectively, without clouded interpretation from personal sights and past images. Their visions are the most perfect, their relations with God the most personal, and they truly are set apart, for they smile more in greater volumes with their useless eyes than most of us do with our sardonically twisted lips. Remember that behind the darkened glasses is inspiration and prophecy beyond the most tantalizing of sights, and that the tinted glass is there to protect your naked mind from being destroyed by the great forces which operate beneath them.